going on with your packets of information, you'll notice that you only have an SMS for House Bill 3260, and you don't have one for House Bill 3253 and House Bill 2360. That's because those two bills, 2360 and 3253, are going to be combined into, or it's the intent of the proponents that they be combined into House Bill 3260. Also, I want to let you know that in your packets of information, you have amendments for House Bill 2201 and 2202. Those aren't in LC form because I didn't get them back from LC yet. Those are the amendments that the proponents submitted, or that I submitted to LC for the proponents. So that's why that's a little bit different.
Open the work session on House Bill 2371. Any discussion? Council, would you just give us a brief update here in case some haven't had a chance to read that?
Okay, thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. As most of you will recall, House Bill 2371 clarifies the use of the term de novo in ORS 215416. And ORS 227175, so that when there's an initial administrative land use permit decision is made without a hearing, the appeal from that decision constitutes the initial evidentiary hearing and allows any party with standing to testify and submit evidence on any relevant issue. there is no revenue impact, and in addition, there is no fiscal impact, although that's not noted on your SMS.
Any questions or discussion?
Madam Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Just to acknowledge that this is the one where I think I bogged the thing down. I tried to rally the troops, and nobody would rally behind me. So I've abandoned my army. I'm ready to go over to the other side, and I will support the bill.
Thank you. Any further discussion?
I will not move it.
I didn't think you would.
Madam Chair, I'll be glad to carry this. Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2371 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Ringo. Call the roll, please.
Representative
McCaffrey?
Aye.
Representative Lowe?
Excuse.
Representative Ringo?
Aye.
Representative
Shetterly? Aye.
Chair
Warner? Aye. Okay, and Representative Ringo, you said you would carry?
Sure.
Okay. House Bill 2371 passes to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Is that worth a trip down from Portland, Chris?
We have two representatives, Representative Shetterly and Representative Patridge, on House Bill 2938. Open the hearing on House Bill 2938. Council, please give us a summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2938 is a bill that is designed to gain additional funding for legal services to the low income in Oregon. What 2938 does, if you're not a member of the Oregon State Bar, you can appear in Oregon court. You have to go through a process where you apply, submit paperwork. That's called, when you do that, when you're not a member, that's called pro hoc vice, which is a fancy way of saying that you don't have a license, but because you have a license in another state, they permit you to appear. At this time, the state of Oregon does not charge a fee for doing that, and some other states do, and the Oregon State Bar is presenting this with the idea that we could get additional funding for legal services. Excuse me.
Thank you.
Good morning, gentlemen. Who's going to go first?
Madam Chair, I will speak very briefly. I'm here in support of House Bill 2938. Representative Shetterly and I, as well as several members of the Oregon State Bar, have been involved during the interim in working to find some additional funding for legal services. Like many programs, but especially this program in the state of Oregon, in order to ensure that justice is served in the state of Oregon, legal services play a vital role in that. But oftentimes in the legislature, people just come looking for a handout of money rather than going to try and find an additional funding source. This bill, House Bill 2938, is the attempt by the Oregon State Bar and the group that worked during the interim a little bit to at least provide a token level of funding, I believe. This does not by any means bridge the gap in the need for legal services, but there are people that will appear before you today on this bill who can explain the need of legal services much better than myself. But this is one of the ways to do this. Several other states do this. I think this will help fill a compelling need in the state of Oregon, and I would urge you to support this particular piece of legislation. We're going to work on some other ways to help fund legal services as well, but I think this is critically important. It doesn't place an onerous burden on out-of-state lawyers coming to Oregon. This happens in other states, and they can articulate some of those other states and give you some of the statistics and other things later, but I would urge your aye vote on this.
Representative Patridge, would you please state your name?
For the record, State Representative Rob Patridge, House District
50.
Madam Chair, for the record, Lane Shetterly, State Representative District 34. I would just echo the comments of Representative Patridge. I think that Ed Harnden, who is here from the bar, can give you an exposition of the need for legal services and, in fact, the gap between the need and what we have in current resources available to provide legal services to the poor in Oregon, and it's not a pretty picture. House Bill 2938, as Representative Patridge said, will not close that gap, but it will move us forward, which is a step in the right direction. We do what we can do. And as Representative Patridge said, there are other proposals out there for additional funding as well. But this is one that, frankly, is a revenue source that we simply are not tapping. Other states do impose fees on out-of-state attorneys who come into state to appear in front of the court. If you are going to practice law here in Oregon, you do pay your bar dues on an annual basis, and that provides for the services that the bar provides to the attorneys and legal system in the state. We don't have a fee that we impose on out-of-state attorneys. This is an opportunity for us to go in that direction, but not just to recover administrative costs, but rather for a very good purpose, to provide legal services funding for the poor and for that significant population of Oregonians who cannot afford legal services themselves and whose needs are not being met by other means such as pro bono services through the Bar Association as well. So this is one more arrow in the quiver. It's a good bill. In fact, as chair of the Revenue Committee, we have a saying that the perfect tax, of course, is one that somebody else pays. And in that sense, this is sort of the perfect fee bill because it's one that we're going to impose on out-of-state practitioners and that no one in Oregon is going to pay. But these people do come in, they do use our court system, they do appear in front of our judges, use our courthouses. I think it's entirely appropriate that we impose a fee on the provision of those services to them and that we then be able to use that fee and the revenues generated to help meet that gap between our needs and our ability at this point to provide legal services to the poor in Oregon. Thank you.
It's difficult. I'm Edwin Harnden, President of the Oregon State Bar. Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's difficult to add anything better to that that's been stated by Representative Shetterly and Patridge. I would add just a couple points, though. One, and to a certain degree, it's a fairness issue. We want to make sure that we're treating attorneys from out of state as fairly as they treat us when we go to their state. And this is one way to do that. But in fact, the lawyers of the state contribute well over $700,000 per year to a campaign for equal justice, which is cash out of their pocket in addition to time that they spend to support legal services for the poor. And I wouldn't come to you if we didn't have that money coming from that group first. But we know that even with that and with the other fundraising efforts, about 80% of the need in Oregon is unmet, and the folks in your legislative districts who are eligible to receive legal services simply can't get them because of the lack of funding. We have about a $10 million gap between the need of the constituents and the supply of the services. And this bill does help to close that gap, or at least allows us to begin closing that gap. There are about 14 other states that have a similar charge for lawyers of other states coming in to use the system and the courts afforded by that state, and the same would be true here. This would allow for the Supreme Court to set up a fee for those out-of-state lawyers. That money would be appropriated to the Oregon State Bar into a dedicated fund for legal services program, that program that was created by the legislature in 1997. I would urge you to support this bill, and I would certainly be happy to answer any questions you might have either on the legal needs study, which established the need, or the other funding mechanisms that we're looking at both amongst lawyers, amongst the public, and elsewhere.
Thank you, Mr. Herndon. Have any questions of the panel?
Madam Chair.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As a practical matter, Ed, do you anticipate or have you a figure in terms of what you hope this this bill will raise? That's a $10 million gap, so that caught my attention. So.
Madam Chair and Representative Backlund, I wish it would raise the $10 million. It would be much easier for all of us. But we
sit down, Karen.
Let me introduce the Executive Director of the Oregon State Bar, Karen Garst, who's been working on this, and we have some figures, but we certainly don't know exactly.
Oh, Madam Chair, Representative Backlund, members of the committee. We've had a really difficult time trying to ascertain exactly how much. Karen Garst.
Thank you.
I'm Executive Director of the Oregon State Bar. We have been working with Brad Swank, who's the administrator for the Supreme Court, and trying to get a handle on that. My guess is between 50 and 200,000, and that's really just a ballpark because we haven't been able to get a good set of data out of that, but we would be happy to come back and report to you and report to the interim as we get that going. We also have we're working on a reciprocity proposal between Washington and Idaho and Oregon. So those people, if we eventually get that and the Supreme Court approves, it's going to take away the Washington people, and that's the bulk of the out-of-state addresses we have. So I think another issue here is it's probably going to be a short-term gap because some of that's going to disappear, but it will help us in the short term close some of that gap. But that's really a guess on my part.
Thank you. Any more questions?
Madam Chair?
Representative Ringo.
I'm just curious as to why the reciprocity.
Madam Chair, Representative Ringo, what we've been working on is trying to address the issue of, you know, lawyers going between states where we have a similarity of treatment of lawyers, similarity of lawyers' professionalism and practice abilities, and to a certain extent a very great similarity of laws that you're dealing with. And we looked at it from a client or customer or constituent basis, and our view was that we were not providing or are not providing the service we need to the general public by drawing a line at the Columbia River. We have people who ask, so you know, call Oregon lawyers and say, you can't cross over the bridge or you can't do this. You can't even talk to me on the phone if you were drawing the line very carefully. So I think it's a public protection, public service aspect of our admissions rules. It certainly hasn't passed yet all the hurdles, and it's also one which the ABA has been looking at to a great degree nationally, and what are we doing in terms of restrictive laws back and forth between attorneys in different states.
Any further questions?
May I?
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Oh, I love this idea. Because it will raise fees and we need that. But have you talked with some of the national law firms who regularly appear in our state on various issues and some of the more well-known national lawyer figures who come in and gotten their input on it.
Madam Chair, Representative Lowe, I have. I've attended, as has Karen Garst, our executive director, several meetings nationally where this is one of the issues that's been discussed in terms of raising funds for legal services, but more particularly with the national law firms that are coming in more often with nationally based clients. I have not heard a significant objection. I doubt that they have talked to their clients to whom some of these fees may be passed at times. My sense is that most of the national firms are very committed to working to provide legal services to the poor nationally as well as in the local areas where they come in to provide service. And I don't think we're going to see a significant or, frankly, any objection from those firms. I think they'll be supportive.
More question, if I could.
Representative Lowe.
I rather suspect that it will probably be the corporate attorneys representing foreign corporations doing business in the state who are probably going to bear the brunt of this. Is that about your expectation?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Lowe, I suspect that the larger amount will be paid by the trial attorneys coming in from out of state as opposed to the corporate attorneys, because they end up not very often filing a pro hoc vici motion, and they're seldom in court. That is another issue which we deal with on the reciprocity end, which is how do corporate attorneys deal with clients that are doing business in many different states, and when they're moving into the state. California's faced that with a court decision that's of some distinction and discussed a great deal. But I don't think we'll see a great deal of objection from even the corporate attorneys coming in.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Close the hearing on House Bill 2938. Open the work session.
Madam Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Move House Bill 2938 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Any further discussion? None.
Clerk call roll.
Representative Johnson? Aye. Representative Lowe? Aye. Representative Ringo? Aye. Representative Shetterly? Aye. Chair Walker? Aye. Okay. House Bill 2938 passes to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Who wishes to carry that one?
Aye. Chair.
Thank you. I thought you were going to do the three together. Mm-hmm. 2360, 3253, and 3260. Okay. I'm going to open the hearing on House Bill 2360, 3253, and 3260. Opening these together because it's my understanding that you wish to have them combined, so I'd like to take your testimony on these all at once.
Madam Chair, and that is our wish in terms of incorporating 2360 into House Bill 3253, I believe are the correct numbers. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate your giving us the time to just very briefly address and I'm Ed Harnden, president of the Oregon State Bar. I'll get that right one of these times.
We'll remind you.
Thank you. I appreciate the time just to address some housekeeping measures and changes to the Bar Act, which is contained in ORS Chapter 9. And basically, these deal with the House of Delegates, which is a governing body within the Oregon State Bar that was created in 1995. The impetus of these changes is fairly simple. We really want to make sure that we retain experienced leaders to do several things. One, to give us leadership within the bar. Two, to maintain some institutional memory. And the leaders are sometimes the most active. And as you know, because you're in that position, a lot of times when you need something done, you go to the person that's the busiest. We have several changes. First is a change which would allow us to allow the Board of Governors to appoint public members from each region, and changes the nomination process, which is somewhat cumbersome. We've found the public members to be just key to our ability to govern the bar in the best manner. They provide just incredible input and advice and assistance and votes on all measures, and particularly measures that directly impact the public and protect the public. We also are proposing to eliminate the committee chairs as ex officio officers. The membership of the bar does not elect the committee chairs. They are appointed by the Board of Governors, and although they're extremely valuable members of the bar and members of our way to get things done, as non-elected members, we felt that it was important that they not be voting members of the House of Delegates, to eliminate any possibility that the Board of Governors is packing the vote. If I thought I could do that successfully, I might give it a try, but these are people that are very independent-minded, but it will just, I think, help us in making sure the House moves forward. Last thing I would mention is that we do change the terms, and we've moved to, we propose to move from 2 3-year terms being allowed to House members to adding to that. It's a change of the term limits, and as I mentioned at the outset, I think it will allow us to continue vital leaders of the bar as members of our House of Delegates. I would be happy to answer any questions, but basically they are housekeeping measures that will help us govern the bar.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Garst, do you have anything you wish to add? Okay, thank you. Any questions of Mr. Harnden?
Comment. Yes, you know, we're a little bit gun shy about changing term limits in this body. So,
any further questions?
Okay.
Okay. And you've covered all three of these very briefly here. That was nice. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. What we will do is to combine these. They will. Council will get them back down to LC and have them combine them. And we can vote on the concept of the combination, since there are no other changes other than the combination. She can take them to LC, get them combined, and bring them back to the full committee. And then we will revote at that time.
Madam Chair, in effect, this would be kind of a conceptual.
Yes, it's a conceptual bill, but it's combining these three into one document. Any questions about the process? Okay, I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2360, 3253, and 3260. I'm going to open the work session.
Madam Chair, do you know into which bill the three will be moved?
I believe it's 2360.
In that case, I would...
No, they're going to be moved into 3260.
Oh, they're going to be moved into 3260.
I think it's just awful that we have it. 2360 and 3260. In that case, Madam Chair, I think the appropriate motion would be to conceptually amend House Bill 3260 by incorporating into it the provisions in House Bill 2360.
And 3260.
Oh, do you want those both in the same motion?
All of them.
Okay, and the same then, incorporating the provisions of House Bill 3253 into House Bill 3260 as conceptual amendment as well.
Thank you. This is the first time I've combined three bills. Okay, we're going to call a vote on the amendment to incorporate 2360 and 3253 into 3260. Any discussion? Okay, hearing no objection. So moved. So ruled.
Madam Chair.
Representative Shirley.
I move House Bill 3260 as conceptually amended by the incorporation into it of House Bill 2360 and House Bill 3253 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Shetterly. Any further discussion? Hearing none, roll call, please.
Representative
Hoffman? Aye.
Representative Lowe?
Aye.
Representative Brindle?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Chair Walker?
Aye. Okay, House Bill 3260 is hereby passed and will be referred to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Excuse me, I should have said as amended to include those bills 2360 and 3253. And who would like to carry those? Or that one, once it comes back? Okay, Representative Lowe will be our carrier. Thank you. Right. Okay. Open hearing on House Bill 2369. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This bill comes to you from the Government Law Section of the Oregon State Bar. It revises the definition of business with which a person is associated for the purposes of government standards and practices law. What this does is modify the definition of business in terms of when a public official has conflicts. I didn't have any information on fiscal or revenue as of 5 o'clock yesterday, and there are dash one amendments that the proponents ask us to adopt.
Thank you. You may proceed. Good
morning, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Dan Olson. I'm the Washington County Council, although today I'm not appearing on behalf of the county. Our board has not taken a position on this bill. Rather, I'm appearing as a director of the Executive Committee of the Government Law Section of the Oregon State Bar. This is a little bit unusual for us because of our diverse membership. A lot of our members are people who make a living regularly suing government, as well as people who are in-house attorneys. We don't generally take position on substantive measures, but we view this as rather a modernization that attempts to, in some ways, lower the restrictions where that makes sense, and also tighten the restrictions where that makes sense. The purpose of House Bill 2369 is to, first of all, recognize that there are a lot of broader financial interests than when when the statute was first adopted, that should be viewed as giving a rise to conflict of interest. The statute currently says that if you own $1,000 of stock or have owned $1,000 of stock during the preceding year in a corporation, or if any of your relatives, as defined, own $1,000 in stock, you have a conflict of interest. Well, nowadays, of course, people own lots of different things. They have stock options, which are not covered by the statute. They have bonds, other types of equity interests that are not covered. So one of the first things this would do would be to include all those into the dollar amount figure, so that a person with $100,000 or $200,000 in stock options is treated the same as a person with $200,000 in stock. Secondly, it recognizes that the current dollar limits are in our view, unrealistic given the changes in the economy. These were first set back in 1974 at $1,000 at a time when not many people owned individual stocks, for one thing, and secondly, of course, stock values were much lower, although, you know, recently that may have changed a little bit. And it does that by distinguishing between two types of companies or businesses. The first is a closely held or private business, you know, the local business or a car dealership or whatever. And we're not proposing to change the rules as regards those. We would keep the $1,000 limit because clearly if an elected official or a staff person has a financial interest in a small company, that's at least potentially something that might influence them. Then we create a second class of company, a publicly held corporation, which could be anything from a Columbia Sportswear or a Nike to, you know, General Motors, anything that publicly trades stock. And we significantly raise the limit there on the theory that there are very few things that a local government is going to be able to do that is going to appreciably alter the stock value of General Motors or Intel. And even if it could, the amount of stock that an individual would have to own to realistically have an influence on their vote would have to be pretty significant. So we proposed raising that level to $100,000. Now, quite frankly, that's an arbitrary number. We sort of bounced numbers around, and that's the number that we came up with. We also added a provision that for officials required by state law to disclose income sources, there's a list in the statutes, they also would have a conflict if the corporation provides 50% or more of the household income, regardless of the nature of the corporation. The other change is that as the law currently is written, if you have a relative who works for a corporation, you have a conflict. And again, in today's society, I'm hesitant to use Washington County as an example because our board has not taken a position on this, but there are a lot of Washington County employees who have relatives who work for Intel or Nike. And it has, in fact, created problems for us. They have a brother or a sister or brother-in-law who works there. And it doesn't, under current law, it can be anybody. It could be your brother-in-law who's a clerk at Costco in Iowa, and you have an issue involving Costco here in Oregon. That's a conflict. This bill would change that such that, again, it doesn't change it at all for small companies or private companies, but for publicly held corporations, you would only have a conflict if your relative is a director or officer of the corporation. Again, someone that might have a significant potential benefit. The reason that this issue it was something that we thought needed consideration is that there are two fallouts, if you will, from a conflict. The first one is if it's an elected official, this means that their constituents effectively are disenfranchised on the issue. And again, an example that we took a look at is if a Costco proposed to locate a new store in a city councilor's district, and let's say her brother is a clerk in Iowa, and maybe she's opposed to the Costco, or maybe she has a lot of constituents who are very concerned about traffic and want certain conditions placed on that Costco, she cannot participate in that decision-making process because she has a conflict under current law. Another example that, and these are all hypotheticals, but they're all based on real-life situations. If a school district was proposing to buy new computers and they have an IS director and maybe some people in-house who are experts on computers, they're obviously going to want those people to review the proposer's proposals. And typically, you're going to get proposals from companies like IBM and Oracle and Microsoft is going to be the software on almost all the computer applications. Well, IS people tend to own stock in those companies. They're into that business, and they feel like they know what stock to buy and what not to buy. Technically, this means that the school district could not use those staff's expertise in evaluating the proposal if they own more than $1,000 in stock. Now, there are ways around that for staff people, but a lot of staff people, you can advise your supervisor, and the supervisor can kind of work around that, but it makes a lot of staff people very nervous. They're concerned that somebody might file an ethics complaint against them, and they're going to have to go through defending one of those, and that's a difficult situation. And there are lots of other situations that we could go through. So again, we view this as both a modernization of the limit to make it reflect current situations more closely, and also tightening it in some ways to reflect current situations more closely. I would, before closing, just point out that we did propose a couple minor changes that are in Section 3B and Section 3C. When we wrote it, we said that if a publicly held corporation of which the person or a member of the person's household owns a certain amount of stock or is a director or officer, that's pretty narrow, the definition of household member. And when we took another look at it, we thought, well, we didn't really mean to change the law that much, so we're proposing that we change it back to relative, which is a little broader definition. So if, again, your brother may not be living in your household, but he may be a director or the president of Nike, that's probably what should be a conflict. And that this would change it back to that. It was sort of an unintended change. And the only other thing I would add is, if I may, is there is one minor change that I did not notice in time to have it drafted, and that's at line 30. The word or there should be and. And the reason for that change is we wanted to make it clear that for public officials required to file a statement of economic interest, they're covered by all of these restrictions, not just that one. And if you have an or in there, someone could maybe argue that they're not subject to the stock restrictions.
That's line 30 on page 1.
I'm sorry, Madam Chairman, on line 30 of page 1, subsection 3, parent C. Okay. And those are my comments. I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee may have regarding our proposal.
Any questions of Mr. Olson? Representative Lowe,
excuse me. proposed change to the law will also help, won't it, in the situation where you have no clue what's in your portfolio and the contents of your portfolio may change from day to day depending upon who's doing the trading. So that would certainly help.
Madam Chairman, Representative Lowe, the Government Standards and Practices Commission takes the position that mutual funds are not covered by current statutes. Now, the statutes don't really say that, but their position is they're not covered because you don't own the stocks directly. So,
Mr. Olson, I only wish I was talking about mutual funds.
Right. And then also I wanted to comment that if you don't know, again, the Ethics Commission has ruled that, well, if you don't know, you can't be held responsible. The problem, of course, is proving that you don't know, and that's a difficult situation.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do we have any? Oh, yes. Representative Rindo?
I'm just mulling over this change from the and or the or. And, I think or is right. I'd just like to be sure about that.
Well,
I mean, you don't want the definition to require that somebody have all four of those.
No.
And that's what and would do.
Madam Chairman, Representative Ringo, the concern we had, and you may be right, what we're trying to do is make it clear that subsection D, which relates to a very limited class of public officials, does not stand alone. They are subject to A, B, C, and D. And that's why we put and. And since this is a definition, really each one of these is a definition of business with which the person is associated. So I think the wording of the bill, or the wording of the existing statute, is such that it would not be interpreted as requiring all four of those. That's clearly not our intent. It might be something that perhaps legislative council would want to look at. And again, I apologize for not noticing that until the last moment.
Senator
Shetterly.
I would be inclined, when we get into work session, to go ahead and move this with the dash one amendments, but leaving or as it is, and maybe just asking council to double check with LC before we get to the full committee to confirm, but they're usually pretty picky about their conjunctive and disjunctive.
Thank you. Thank you. Any further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2369. Open the work session. 2369. Any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
I move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2369.
Thank you. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, I pass the amendments to House Bill 2369. I would entertain a motion for the bill.
Here.
I'm sorry, Representative Ringo.
I don't want to deprive.
No? I'm sorry. Which one here? I saw you both nod.
Well, I move 2369 to the full committee, just with the understanding that we will look at that one phrase.
As amended?
As amended.
Thank you, Representative Ringo. Any discussion? I think we should, too, also have them look at that line 30. I tend to think that the or should be there, but I think since there's been a question raised, we need to find out about that before it does go to the full committee. Okay, no further discussion. Roll call.
Representative Backlund?
Aye.
Representative Wright?
Aye.
Representative Ringo?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Chair Walker?
Aye. House Bill 2369, as amended, is approved and hereby moved to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. And Council, will you take care of it?
Yes, I will.
I'm so sorry. Yes, Representative Ringo, would you want to carry that one?
Sure.
Okay, Representative Ringo will carry that. Okay. Next will be House Bill 2201 and 2202.
If I could just point out to members of the committee, you were just handed the LC draft of 2201 and 2202, the amendments to them. Yes.
I'm going to open the hearings on House Bill 2201 and 2202. We're having these together because of the subject matter and the individuals testifying, but we are not combining the two bills. I don't want you to think we're doing that. Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm Ken Cudell. I'm the administrator of both the Landscape Contractors Board and the Construction Contractors Board. I have been the administrator of those boards for approximately 18 years. And today, Bill Boyd is going to present the particulars of these bills to you. Bill is manager of our claims resolution division. And I'm here because I haven't appeared before this committee this year. There are something like 30-some bills that will impact Construction Contractors Board that actually amend 701 that are under consideration. There are about close to a dozen that would amend the Landscape Contractors Act. And so we'll likely be before your committee again at some point on one or more of these other bills. The other reason I wanted to appear before you is to introduce our new administrator who's in back, and if he'd raise his hand, you could see him, Craig Smith.
Morning.
I'm retiring effective June 30th. Other committees have said, because I used the term as soon as you adjourn, and they said no, maybe before that date. But anyway, I'm leaving on June 30th, and my board has done the right thing, and we went through a very extensive process and selected an individual, and so Craig has got the opportunity to learn from me all of the things mostly not to do. In 18 years, I've learned a lot. Boards, both of these boards really like this concept that we're proposing today, and that's to move about 5,000 claims a year with Construction Contractors Board, between 4,000 and 5,000. As many as 1,000 of those would go to a hearing or up to that point. These bills would allow, unless the parties object, that those disputes would be resolved at that point in arbitration, which we believe in the years that we've been involved in dispute resolution, that when you're creating this program today, that's what you would have done, is created the program. But it was created in 1971. We've been at this dispute resolution, disputes between primarily between a contractor and their clients for negligent or improper work or breach of contract. And we do a pretty good job of it. This is just something that we believe is the right thing to do. It's been under discussion for about 6 years, and this is the first time it's come forth as a bill. So with that, I'm going to depart here and leave it to Bill Boyd, who has the knowledge in this, and recommend that you give favorable consideration to both of the bills. Thank you
very much. Enjoy your retirement.
Thank you.
Chair Walker, my name is William Boyd. I'm the manager of the Claims Resolution Section of the Construction Contractors Board and the Landscape Contractors Board. As Ken told you, the CCB and the LCB resolve disputes between contractors and their customers, and also some other people like material suppliers who do business with them, and generally the issues are the same issues that would arise in a suit in front of a court of law over a breach of contract. There are breach of contract issues and also whether the work was done properly. We get about 5,000 claims on the CCB side, considerably fewer claims. I don't have the number right off the tip of my tongue on the LCB side. And a certain number of those, as Ken mentioned, go to a hearing. The vast majority of those get resolved through the other procedures we have with the two boards. A hearing performs the same function as a trial. In our case, it's an administrative hearing. It's normally conducted as a contested case hearing, and it's conducted by hearing officers from the hearing officer panel. There are some cases on the Construction Contractors Board side that are conducted as arbitrations already. If the amount at issue is $1,000 or less, those cases are conducted as arbitrations, and again, we're using hearing officers from the panel as arbiters for those cases. We also arbitrate claims where both sides, through one manner or another, have agreed to have the case arbitrated. Sometimes that's because their contract specifies the Construction Contractors Board or the Landscape Contractors Board as the arbiter, and sometimes during the course of the dispute, the two parties just get together and decide they'd rather have it heard as an arbitration as opposed to a contested case. As Ken mentioned, if we set this program up today, we think we would have probably set it up to use arbitration from the get-go, because arbitration provides some advantages in the process, and we believe that it makes it fairer. Our major concern usually focuses around the determination of damages. In a contested case, the hearing officer can only award damages that are established by evidence on the record, and if the evidence is contradictory, the hearing officer has to choose one party's evidence or the other's. Typically, most parties in our hearings are unrepresented. They're unsophisticated. They don't come with all of the knowledge of dealing with a hearing situation that an attorney would. And so claimants often, in their zeal, overstate their damages. They had a very cheap contractor bid the job and do the job, and now they're making a claim against that contractor, but then they go out and get a bid for damages for the repair of that job from the high-end contractor like Neil Kelly. And so you have, you know, a job that was really bid at about $2,000, but the repair is, you know, for doing the same work is significantly, you know, two or three times that. On the other side, the contractor, in their belief that they're right, often comes with no bid to do the repair work. So that if the hearing officer recognizes that the one bid is overstated and there is no bid on the other side, they're left with the unhappy choice of either awarding the overstated amount or awarding nothing at all. Arbitration provides a way out of this dilemma. Arbitrators have more leeway to fashion an equitable award that's been sort of long recognized in the history of arbitration and the tradition of arbitration. And it also comes out of the fact that the reviewing court, if the award is appealed, doesn't look at the actual merits of the action. An appellate court looks at things like whether the arbiter was insane or on the take or all these sort of extreme things, which, frankly, I doubt ever come up in Oregon situations. And so I'm going to move on to the fact that in arbitration, generally, as a practical matter, there is really no appeal from an arbitration award. You have to show these extreme kinds of things. That's good in one sense because the whole process gets done quicker. You don't have these, pesky appeals floating around. And in a real way, an appeal of a contested case is somewhat illusory. It is pretty rare for the appeals committee of the board to actually change the decision of a hearing officer in a contested case, and it's even rarer for the appellate court to change that. So, most of the appeals are the result is an affirmation of the hearing officer's decision. But there is, because there is no effective appeal, that does raise a problem because occasionally hearing officers do make mistakes. Our appeals committee regularly catches math errors, or sometimes the hearing officer said this person is entitled to damages for this issue, but when you add up, the list of how they arrived at those damages, somehow that got left off. And so we make those corrections. We think that we can change the arbitration procedure a little bit by requiring that a hearing officer who's acting as an arbiter accept and respond to a motion for reconsideration by the party that believes that there's been some error on the face of the award. The two bills that you have before you recognize that arbitration is voluntary. So what we do is if nobody does anything, it'll be heard as arbitration, but any party can request that the case be heard as a single party can request that a case be heard as a contested case, and it will be heard as a contested case, or either party can take the claim into court. If one party requests contested case and the other party requests that it be done in court, then it will be done in court. We've set the bill up to allow the CCB to set this program up by rule. There's several reasons for that. It's a kind of a new idea, and we want to be able to adjust it as we get more experience with it. The other reason for that is that we are giving up a considerable amount of control over our cases because we will no longer have arbitrations don't come to the appeal committee, and therefore we don't have that sort of stop or second look at an opinion after the hearing officer panel gets done with it. The hearing officer panel is essentially the last party that has it. And we would like to be able to at least have that control of being able to pull the program if we aren't satisfied with the way things are working. The amendments, there were some amendments in here that provided, and I'm not so sure they got drafted by LC, that provided that the hearing officer would be drawn from the hearing officer panel. And then there was a second set of amendments that came about after I had discussions at the end of last week with Bruce Miller from the State Court Administrator's Office, and he made some suggestions which I thought were important. So what you have here, you should have a document that looks like this, a second set of proposed House amendments to HB 201, and there should be another document that says same thing to HB 2202.
If I might interrupt, I just wanted to. We also did get the paperwork up from LC. This should be that. Like, if you have 2201-A2, it should be the same as the draft that you also have.
Great.
We just got those today.
We just got them this morning.
I haven't seen those, but I have very much confidence in LC's work. They've done great work for us. And finally, I want to take, before I take any questions, I just want to take this opportunity to tell you that when the hearing officer panel was set up, our agency, like many, opposed the idea. We wanted to be left out of it. We weren't happy with it. I think we probably struggled harder than most. After a year's experience with the hearing officer panel, I have to say that it's working great for us. We're really pleased with it. I think it's a good program. I'm not going to say we haven't had problems, but those were things that maybe we had to adjust in our procedures anyway, and we're very pleased with it. And we are very supportive of the hearing officer panel and in the concept. And frankly, if I could see it made permanent today, I would be happy to do that. So that's the end of my testimony.
Thank you. I'm glad that Representative Shetterly came back in the room about that time to hear your comments about the central panel. Representative Ringo.
I've done a few cases before the Construction Contractors Board, but I don't remember some of the details. And the first question is, what's the fee for the person bringing the claim? What do they have to pay?
Chair Walker, Representative Ringo, there is no fee to bring a claim.
All right. And so if somebody brings a case under the arbitration system you're contemplating, would there be a fee?
Representative Walker, Representative Ringo, no. We don't contemplate a fee, and we don't have any authority, I don't think. We have the authority to request a deposit, and we've never used it because the procedures, it's a little vague as to exactly, you know, what you're giving back. Deposits usually are refundable, and so we've never actually imposed that.
Madam Chair, it sounds to me like one of your main goals here is to create more finality in the process so that it'll be resolved at, say, the arbitration level and not have appeals. So is that really where you're going?
Chair Walker, Representative Ringo, that's not our goal. It's a byproduct of our actual goal, which is to, we feel that the contested case process sometimes arrives at results that are unjust.
Well, to me that seems like a different matter, though, where you said that in a hearing that the hearings officer didn't have equitable power to make a compromise that perhaps he or she saw fit.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I understand that, but one of the other impacts of this is to make it so that you just don't appeal and have a new hearing at a higher level.
That's the byproduct, and what my contention is that that's not an entirely an unhappy byproduct. That sometimes it prevents somebody from dragging out the inevitable.
I'm being waived to go testify at another hearing, but I'll just say that I think that's a good thing. I mean, in my experiences before the Construction Contractors Board, it was always a little frustrating to tell the client, well, we're going to do this all here, we're going to put in all our evidence, but I can't guarantee you that it's going to stop here because they can just keep ratcheting it up. And I think one of the things that claimants need in disputes like this is a sense of finality, that you're going to have your day in court and let's do the best job we can, and that's going to be it. Anyway, and having said that, I'm going to run.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Representative.
If I could make one final comment
to
that, Chair Walker, sometimes it is sort of frustrating to see a $2,000 claim, which if it had gone to small claims court would have been cut off, you know, as soon as the decision was made, get dragged on to, you know, the appeals committee and then possibly to the Court of Appeals. There is a point where you have to wonder whether the amount that's at issue is really worth all of that process. But on the other hand, sometimes, you know, if you have a $50,000 claim, somebody might argue, gee, I should get a little more process.
Any further questions? Thank you very much. And Bruce Miller.
Morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller from the State Court Administrator's Office. I just got the amendments this morning, got a chance to look at them. We had two issues that jumped out at us when we looked at the bill, and I'll refer to the A. and Gross 2201, the old one, not the new LC one that came before you today. The first issue was on page 2, lines 42 and 43. That's in section 3, sub 3, sub C. And there was language in there that said notwithstanding ORS 36.350, which deals with arbitration awards. We'd found that language a little bit confusing, but upon looking at the amendments this morning, I see they've deleted that language, so that issue should be resolved. The second issue on 2201 came in two sections on page 3, which would be section 3, subsection 5, and subsection 9. And as we read those, it appeared to us that a contractor could force a claimant to file a lawsuit even if the claimant didn't, and we thought there might be a fiscal impact on that. As I read the amendments, they have written language that eliminates that problem. So I think that issue is resolved as well, although I just got these amendments and just quickly looked at them. I think they've addressed both those problems. And those were the problems that I brought up with Mr. Boyd last week. And that's all I have.
Thank you. Any questions of Mr. Miller? Thank you very much.
Oh. And I would add that same language is in 2202, and the amendments to 2202 also address the problems there. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Anyone else wish to testify on 2201 or 2202? Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Are you going to, before you close this, we'll do some working on the amendments, I assume. Is that, or we're going to wait for them to come back?
Well, we have these amendments that came in today. So did you see those? And apparently they incorporate this into it. Do you want,
I don't,
more time to review it?
I don't know. You know, in the words of the Legislative Council's revisers bill, it's more futzing than anything. But it's interesting. There's some terminology here that it strikes me as curious in the drafting of these amendments. For instance, on line 17, we have on the first page, or files an action. Then it goes on to say, a party making a request or court filing under this subsection. That's just curious terminology. You file a complaint, and then, you know, so the next sentence would be a party making a request or filing a complaint under this subsection. You see that again down in line 23, and it refers to party files an action. And then on page 2, line 10, beginning on line 9, the party that is subject to paragraph A or B of this section must make delivery. I mean, it's ticky, but it seems to me we're talking about must deliver a request. I don't know why we have make delivery of. And it's just kind of strange drafting. I'm not used to seeing this kind of language coming out of LC, and you see that again where it says make delivery of on line 31 on page 4 and on page 5, line 3, failure to make a timely delivery. It's odd language. I was hoping that maybe there's going to be something, some other amending or something done on this so we could have LC take a look at this. Does it strike anybody else in this committee as odd?
Obviously, you were speed reading because I haven't read all of this amendment when it came, since we just got it today.
Yeah. I don't think it, you know, I'm happy to move it if you're inclined. I don't want to slow this down, but maybe if we do between now and the Senate or somewhere, we could have somebody look at this. It just seems to me to be the kind of language that we would see next session coming through in the revisers bill, cleaning up syntax
futzing.
That's right.
Futzing with
it. Yeah.
That's probably going to become part of the vernacular of the legislature in this committee. I would like to ask your recommendation as to whether you think we should look through this before we pass it to the full committee or pass it to the full committee and take it up between now and then.
Well, that would be next week instead of this week. Is that right?
I hope you all know this. We're not having a full committee meeting on Friday. It's been moved to Thursday after the subcommittee meeting. So we wouldn't have a lot of time if we were to do it this week. We could do it in front of the full a week from Friday.
I think that, if I may, I agree with Representative Shetterly that, you know, we have a duty to turn out the best work product that we possibly can for the people. I mean, and if the drafting is archaic or awkward, perhaps we ought to work with Elsie to try and tidy it up so that challenges don't come up.
I agree. I don't want us to put something out of here that we're going to see a bill next time that comes in and cleans up, as you call it, archaic
language.
What we did,
yeah.
What we did this time. So,
untidy.
but what I'm going to do is I'm going to close the hearing and have Representative Shetterly.
I just gave my.
Okay.
And it's not it's not complete, but it kind of raises the issue.
Right.
It's kind of strange.
And if we can change some of those terms to be more. To be more clear for those people reading it in more everyday language that is used throughout the statutes, then we'll bring it back, and then we'll pass it on. I don't want to take it to the committee without doing that. So I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2201 and 2202, and we will bring it back once we have some language clarified for us and go into work session at that time. Okay. Thank you.
If I might, Madam Chair, I also wanted to let the committee know, since we're sort of talking about it, next Wednesday we have scheduled our regular 8 o'clock meeting and have a pretty full schedule, although, as we know from Monday and Wednesday, I'm just not very good at figuring out which bill is going to be controversial and which one isn't. Since we're going to get done by 9:20 today, we could use some of that time on Monday. But next Wednesday, we're going to have the morning meeting, and then we're also going to have, we're going to come back at 3:30, and at that time, I've got 10 bills set for work session. So hopefully they're all stuff that we saw before. They're the bar bills, a lot of other things we've already talked about, and so hopefully that will move through that quickly. But I could probably add this to that where it won't be any additional discussion, just yes, the changes have been made or not.
May I?
Yes,
Andrea, could you please let Representative Hill know, because e-government is a Ways and Means and e-government policy committee has served on, and it's only a committee of three souls. So if we encroach into that time, that committee really can't meet. So would you please let Representative Hill know so that he can make some alternative scheduling?
Okay, and I'll try to, I think what we need to do is we need to work, what we're going to need to work, this is going to be an ongoing problem. I think that you all got the memo from Chair Williams about the fact that we're going to have to start going on into the afternoon, and so we need to, I guess, as a committee, determine what time that's going to need to be in the future.
Manager, as long as we're on that, for council and Dr. Representative Williams, I don't covet evening meetings, but I know most of us have either afternoon appointments or other committee meetings that we're regularly committed to. I think if we're going to be extending, we may have to do it into evening hours, because it's hard to carve out that extra couple of hours during the day. I'm probably booked for 3 weeks ahead till 5 o'clock.
Thank you. Yeah, I would echo Representative Shetterly's comments. I think it might be perhaps more easily arranged.
So long as it doesn't involve pizza, I'm fine.
Yeah. Or Madam Chair?
Yeah, Representative Shetterly.
We've done it at 7 in the morning, too.
Ooh.
The extra hour on that side.
Pizza, I'll take pizza.
I've done it.
Now 7 pizza.
And if I could, Madam Chair, I just would suggest to you, and I'm sure you'll do this anyway, that you all just discuss your concerns with Chair Williams, because I just do what I'm told. So I'll be happy to express your concerns to him, but I think this is also something that needs to be addressed as a committee.
Okay. Next Wednesday for sure.
That's correct. Next Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, he has asked for afternoon sessions.
Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday?
Okay.
Well, not for your subcommittee. So, for example, you would only be working on Wednesday.
Wednesday at 3:30.
Although, actually, I believe there might also be a meeting on Monday to hear, is that when the civil commitment bills are?
Boy.
I don't recall.
No, it's not next Monday?
I don't recall.
Is it following Monday?
Okay. Okay, so we have 3:30 for the civil committee.
On Wednesday,
on Wednesday
for sure.
Next Wednesday.
One that's
week
correct.
The full judiciary is this Thursday, and that's going to be basically an all day, right after the criminal?
That's correct. There, I think.
Or is it full all day?
It's, no, it's full at 8 in the, at eight. Or 8:30,
we'll
I believe.
We'll talk about this tomorrow.
Yeah.
We got some problems.
Well, I think we need to kind of look at our schedule. That's why I wanted to.
Yeah. And as I said, I just recommend that you talk to Mr. Taylor and Chair Williams and just let the rest of us know what to do.
Yeah, we talked about this.
Okay, we have one more bill.
That's bad.
Okay, we have one more bill, House Bill 2983. We have Charlotte Benz, David Cook. Open the hearing on House Bill 2983.
If I might, Madam Chair, I'll let the speakers describe the bill for you, but I just wanted to give you a little bit of information. There's no revenue impact, and I know that Fiscal was concerned about it. I had spoken to Judy James from Fiscal, and she wanted to know. She had heard that there were Dash 1 amendments that would change the fiscal, and as of a couple of days ago, I told her, I don't know anything about that. I just got them yesterday, so I haven't been able to talk to Judy as to what the fiscal implications are of the amendments.
Okay. Please. Chair Walker, members of the committee, I'm Charlotte Benz, president of the Heritage Cemetery Group, and one of the proponents of this bill. Karen Wells could not attend this morning. David Coe, who is the executive director of the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board, is with me this morning. We have worked out these Dash 1 amendments between our organization and the Mortuary and Cemetery Board. And this bill does two things. First, it eliminates the current statute, the language that reads that any cemetery that has an outstanding financial obligation is therefore an operating cemetery. Under the law, any cemetery organization that is required, for instance, to file articles of incorporation with the corporation division or annual reports with justice, in fact, even having a checking account in some cases, would give that cemetery organization an outstanding financial obligation. And so in the bill, printed bill line 22, taken that language out. And we feel that that's more in keeping with what an operating cemetery should be. The other thing that this bill does is exempt the smaller operating cemetery, those with five or fewer burials annually, from fees for any change in principal except for a change in the cemetery manager, and that is in the Dash 1 amendments. Cemeteries that have five or fewer burials annually have little or no revenue to pay the fees for changing a principal. Oftentimes, those boards are volunteer boards. Sometimes they were just family members or community members that have come together to operate the cemetery. And basically, in many cases, the turnover of principals is frequent, and it becomes a hardship in going through the process of being required to pay $50 fees and a complete background check on any board member. We feel like that is unnecessary for the most part on volunteer boards. And it does create a hardship on some of the smaller ones, especially if you get several board members at a time. So we feel that that is unnecessary as well, and we've worked that out with the Mortuary and Cemetery Board. That's basically what I have to say, and I hope that you would support this bill.
Thank you. Mr. Coe.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Coe. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board. I'm here today on behalf of the board to support House Bill 2983 as amended. The changes proposed in HB 2983 are fair and reasonable, and I believe they deserve your favorable consideration. I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have them.
Thank you. Any questions of the panel? Okay. There was some question of financial impact as a result of these amendments. Do you see where that might be or could occur?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the fiscal impact, I believe, will be negligible. It's not going to be something that's going to have any dramatic impact on the board's budget. It's even possible that it would be a wash if fees are reduced in a sense for smaller cemeteries. We know that there are many out there that have not yet come forward to obtain an initial license. Of course, when we come across them, we go through that process. But if fees for these smaller cemeteries are reduced, they may actually step forward and apply for a license. So in the end, it might even be a wash.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2983. Open work session.
Madam Chairman, I move that we adopt the amendment, -1 amendments to 2983.
Thank you. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, we adopt amendments to House Bill 2983, the -1.
Madam Chairman, I move that we move House Bill 2983 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Any discussion? Roll call, please.
Representative Backman? Aye.
Representative Love?
Aye.
Representative Ringo?
Excuse.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Chair Walker? Aye. House Bill 2983 passed to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Thank you. And Representative Lowe requests that we suspend with the rules to allow her to vote on House Bill 2371. I hereby open the work session. Representative Lowe, how do you vote?
Aye.
Thank you. House Bill 2371, hereby closed. And yes.
Did you need a carrier for that last bill?
Yes, I do. I'm sorry. Thank you, Representative Backman.
I would be happy to do that.
Personally. Representative Backman will carry that bill for us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We are concluded. Hereby concluded.
Shoot. Work for another hour.